All right, good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is June 13th, 2023. The arguments today, we have two on our calendar, and they are proceeding by a video conference. And I see the attorneys are here and present. I'll ask the marshal to call the first case.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfold, Judge Werke, Judge Connolly, the Honorable Diane B. Bradfold presiding. The first case is A221329, Thomas Anthony Greshowak and all appellants versus Adam Paul Greshowak and all respondents.
And counsel, I have just a few remarks and then we'll go ahead with the argument. I just want to remind you of a couple of things. First of all, we are proceeding by video conference, but really all of our procedures are the same as usual. We do make a recording of today's argument, an audio recording. It's the only recording that's allowed, and it will later be posted on the court's website. So we ask you to do a couple of things to maintain that record. So before you start your remarks, if you would introduce yourself and the client you represent, and then keep an eye on the clock. It should be visible on your screen and it will count down for you. So we enjoy our conversations with you. We always look forward to them, but the time tends to go quickly. So with that, please proceed. Counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Judges Werke, Judge Connolly, Judge Bradfold presiding. My name is Jack DeWalt. I'm appearing, as noted previously, for appellants, Mr. and Ms. Thomas and Jamie Greshowak. My clients are the parents of Mr. Adam Greshowak. Mr. Adam Greshowak is one of the respondents in this case, and my clients are also the grandparents of the two minor children who are the subject of this proceeding. The Greshowaks are asking the court today to overturn the district court order dated July 13th. The subject of the proceeding, Your Honors, is Statute 518C.08, and as drafted, it is discriminatory. By definition, 518C.08 creates two distinct classes of grandparents and grandchildren. One class are those who have the right to maintain a statutorily protected right to contact with each other, and the other class does not. The sole differentiation, Your Honors, between those two classes is the status of the parents who are the parents of the children in question. You can see this throughout the statute in the first three subdivisions, but principally within subdivision two, Your Honors. Insofar as subdivision two states in relevant part, the court may, upon the request of the parent or grandparent of a party, grant reasonable visitation rights to the unmarried child after dissolution of marriage, legal separation, annulment, or determination of paternity. That means, Your Honors, by design, if a child's parent is not deceased or has not been involved in one of these statutorily enumerated legal proceedings, or the child has not resided with the grandparents for a period of 12 months or more, a grandparent may not seek relief under that statute. This is true even if the visitation would be in the best.
Mr. DeWalt, just for our focus, so then you're asking us as an appellate court to focus entirely on the language then in subdivision two.
You're not
raising any other issue. There's not a deceased parent, and they're not claiming your clients are not claiming that the child resided with them for 12 months. You're focusing on subdivision two of the statute.
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Your Honor. As I was noting, what's important for this matter is that the relationship that's protected or determined who can have standing to seek a protected relationship is then based solely on the status of the parents, as the court's kind of alluded to, or I've certainly called out within statute, and then also is not based at all on the best interests of the children or whether or not my clients can show that such a contact schedule would not interfere with the parent-child relationship. So the result of this, Your Honors, is that we have a system of classes created whereby, and I think it's unique within Minnesota family law, that when a statutorily protected right to visitation is enumerated by statute, so we have 257C08, it provides a certain group of grandparents the right to proceed further. It is the only area, I believe, in our law that determines whether that contact should occur, that's been enumerated, not based on the best interest of the children or not based on whether it would interfere with the parent-child relationship, but based solely on, for lack of a better word, the status of a parent. And in fact, marital status, if you're divorced, you grandparents have the right to proceed. If you're unmarried and there's a paternity action, you have the right to proceed. So in doing that—
Counsel, if I may, it sounds to me like you are presenting, and that's the way your brief is written as well, a facial challenge to this statute. Is that correct?
That is correct, as drafted, Your Honor.
In the brief, as drafted in the brief. And I guess why I'm asking is because the district court very specifically rejected an as-applied challenge. And if that challenge was not presented in district court, it's our usual practice not to hear it or consider it in this court.
The challenge that is raised in the brief is the same challenge raised at the district court, Your Honor. And you can see that in the trial memorandum that was presented to the district court. I think the court's rejection of my client's arguments at best was very summary. And in fact, the order itself, I think, was limited to 2 pages. And the memorandum itself very shortly addressed the equal protection or constitutional challenges. So
you're telling me that the district court made a mistake. It wasn't an as-applied challenge. It was that you made a facial challenge in district court, or did you make both? I'm trying to understand.
The challenge that we raised both at district court and at this level, Your Honor, is a facial challenge as drafted for 257C08, principally subdivision 2. And that is seen through the petition of the appellants at both at the district court, as well as the legal memorandum.
So I apologize if I'm being indirect. Did you make an as-applied challenge in district court?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
You made both. But here you're only making one, is that right? Facial challenge?
I am arguing facially as drafted 257C08, principally subdivision 2, by definition creates 2 separate classes of both grandparents and children, Your Honor, correct?
Well, the reason I'm pursuing this isn't just to see whether you made the same argument to district court, but to also explore with you, you know, you failed to give notice to the Attorney General's office of facial challenge when you moved this case up to the appellate courts. The Attorney General's made us aware of that. You know, we all are aware that there's was a special term decision that entrusted it to this panel to decide whether to hear the challenge. And I guess facial challenges, it's important for us to hear from the Attorney General, and your failure to give notice gives me pause. So would you like to discuss that?
Of course, Your Honor, and I'm happy to. I think the record reflects, as soon as it was brought to my attention, we attempted to remedy that. I brought the motion to this court asking for an extension for the Attorney General to be allowed to intervene, or at least have the opportunity to. And I think it's notable, Your Honors, that I did provide notice at the district court level. So there was certainly, there was no intent to preclude the Attorney General's office from the right to be involved in this proceedings, should they so choose to do so. All pleadings have been provided to the Attorney General's office. And I think it's notable, Your Honor, that the Attorney General actually said in their correspondence to this court that they would not be participating in this proceeding after having constructive notice and having the opportunity to do so. So when we look at, you know, when there's been an oversight in that nature, the question becomes, was there an action to remedy? What is the harm that potentially comes from that? I would identify, Your Honor, that I think within 24 hours, I brought the motion, I provided notice to the Attorney Generals, and the Attorney Generals have not given any indication of an intent to be involved. And in fact, they specifically said not. So to the extent that there was an oversight, I fully explained that in the affidavit that I provided to the court as accompanying my motion. Notice was provided at the district court level. I've taken accountability as much as I think as I was able to, and I sought to remedy the action. And given the issue that the Attorney General has not chosen to participate despite those things, I think that that's notable when considering that issue, Your Honor.
May I understand, Mr. DeWaltman, are you suggesting we write a published opinion that says grandparents have a fundamental right to visit grandchildren?
I think that, yes, Your Honor. I think the court has 2 options before, and this is the way I also address this to the district court. One is 257C08, because of the way it's drafted, limits the class of grandparents and by extension then classes of children who have the right to a statutorily protected relationship.
Well, if we were to do that, how does that square with the recognized constitutional right of parents to raise their children in the way they wish? I mean, aren't you, I mean, I guess I don't understand how we could do that. It seems to me if we said that, that would directly conflict with established precedent that says the opposite. So why am I wrong?
I'm not in a position to say you're wrong, Your Honor. In fact, I'm asking you to agree with me. But Troxell v. Granville, which is the seminal case when we look at grandparent rights, says that in order for a statute or a grandparent visitation statute to survive scrutiny, it has to provide some level of deference. It can't be just a best interest standard. That was the statute coming out of Washington.
Well, did that case say grandparents have a fundamental right to see their grandchildren?
Oh, no, Your Honor. I misunderstood the question.
If the Supreme Court didn't say that, why on earth would we, as an error-correcting court, say that?
I'm not arguing that the grandparents have a fundamental right. I'm arguing that when the legislature created 257C08 and it based the rights of grandparents and children to contact solely on the status of their parents, it is per se unconstitutional.
I think as I understand the argument, but I think in order to say that, we would have to then make the leap to saying that grandparents have a fundamental right to see their grandchildren. I don't see how we get to what you want to do without saying the first, and I don't see how we could say the first.
The first, Your Honor, is that 257C08 came into being. And when 257C08 came to being and the legislature decided to protect grandparents' visitation, they needed to do so in a way that did not violate equal protection. They did that by creating classes of children whose parents, based solely on their status, those children have the right to either maintain contact or not maintain contact. So either this legislature needed to say, and I think either way I certainly would not argue with, there is not going to be a grandparent visitation statute in Minnesota. Fine, there's no argument here. We would dispute these under common law principles. But once they did protect that, Your Honor, it became problematic that they did so in a way that solely granted rights for children and by extension grandparents to those children and grandparents determined solely by the status of the parents. And as the court noted, I believe it was in In re Santoro, the purpose of 257C08, to quote, was to ameliorate the harshness of the common law rule, which provided very little remedy for grandparents outside of in loco parentis doctrine. So in doing so, Your Honor, what happened with 257C08, frankly, is that it ameliorated the common law rule only for some classes of grandparents and some classes of children, and not for others. And when the court looks at the cases that were provided, looking at similar situations where laws are differentiating between children based solely on the status of their parents, those have been found presumptively unconstitutional. So that's the problem, Your Honor. It's not that that the court or the legislature didn't do it in a way that was constitutionally correct as it relates to parents. What they did was unconstitutionally incorrect as it relates to grandparents and grandchildren.
Okay, so as I understand the argument, the legislature has created two classes of grandparents.
Correct.
The class under the statute who, under those factual circumstances, would get visitation. And then what's the other class? Everyone else, including your clients?
Everyone else, yes. There's three classes, principally of grandparents that have the right to visitation in Minnesota under 257C08. One is
if that's the case, then if it's everyone else, then everyone else has a fundamental right to see their grandchildren. And I thought that was sort of not what you're saying, that they don't. So how do they, I don't see how we get to even under the equal protection argument, how we get to where you want us to be without saying grandparents have a fundamental right to see their grandchildren.
No, grandparents have the right to be treated equally under the law. And when the legislature granted
some— And what is the law? The law is that as of right now, is it fair to say grandparents don't have a fundamental right to see their grandchildren? Is that the law that currently applies?
Correct.
Okay. So, okay. So what other classes then, I mean, I guess I don't see how, and maybe I'm just dense. I don't, and maybe you want to save this for your rebuttal. I'm not so sure I get to see where you want us to go without saying they have a fundamental right, because that differentiates the class. So maybe you can think about that when it's time for your rebuttal.
I think I've got a very short period. I think what I'm maybe misunderstanding the question, that if it obviously it would be me as the dense one, Your Honor, not you, but is the grandparents don't have a fundamental right to contact to grandchildren. Grandparents do have a fundamental right to equal protection under the law. This is a citizen of the U.S. or a citizen of Minnesota, does, and of the U.S. That would be the right that's in question, Your Honor. And that's the right that we argue is being violated. I can certainly respond more on rebuttal. I don't have the time in front of me, but on my own clock, I think I'm right out of time. So
you are, okay. Counsel. And so you should be able to see the clock on your screen if you've got it adapted to a gallery view. You know how to do that.
I do know how to do that. It's not up, but I'll make sure I keep track of the 5 minutes.
Right. It just might be helpful for when you return for rebuttal. But thank you, counsel. I appreciate your inquiry. And so with that, I think we're ready to move on to counsel for respondent. The clock has been reset. You've got 15 minutes, Ms. Lammers. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. My name is Katie Lammers. May it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the respondents today in this matter. The way that I look at this, there's two issues before the court here today. First, did the district court err in dismissing the appellant's petition without a hearing on the merits, including consideration of the common law right to grandparent visitation? And second, is Minnesota Statute 257C08 constitutional? Your Honors had raised the issues with the procedural matters regarding service to the Attorney General, and I would like briefly to address that. As you're aware, the Attorney General did not receive timely notice pursuant to Minnesota Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 144. We did receive correspondence from the Minnesota Attorney General's office that they stated that they were not seeking to intervene in this case because of the lack of notice and the fact that the district court decision did not address the merits of the constitutional law. As Your Honors were aware, Chief Judge Siegel filed an order dated March 27th of 2023 that deferred how to handle those issues to the panel here today. I'm asking that this court decline to address the constitutionality of the issue, or at least limit the issue to an as-applied challenge. I'll still address the constitutionality of the statute in my remarks today. Further, Your Honors, I'm requesting that you affirm the district court's decision dated August 19th, 2022 in all respects. A couple of words on the standard of review. Whether a complaint sets forth a legally sufficient claim is a de novo review by this court. The existence of standing is also reviewed de novo. However, strict scrutiny is the appropriate standard of review when fundamental rights are at issue, and the court has declared clearly and unequivocally that a fit parent's right to make decisions regarding the care, custody, and control of his or her child is a protected fundamental right. Turning then to the first issue, the district court properly dismissed the appellant's petition. Minnesota Statute 257C08 governs the rights of visitation to unmarried persons. The Minnesota State Legislature created this statute specifically to outline the circumstances where third parties, such as biological grandparents, may have standing to petition the court for visitation. Your Honors, the statute is clear and unambiguous. The appellants in this case admit that they do not have standing under Minnesota Statute 257C08 to pursue visitation with their grandchildren. That point is not disputed.
Counsel, if I could, you referenced standing, and you're certainly right that the appellants don't challenge that they don't qualify. They do not meet the requirements of 257C.08. I'm just curious whether you've given any thought to whether meeting the statutory requirements is the same as standing. Standing usually means that a party has been aggrieved or injured in some way. And it is certainly true that the complaint, and we take all allegations in the complaint favorably to the appellants, the complaint alleges an injury by the petitioning parties. So how does that factor into the statutory requirements?
So making sure that I'm understanding your question correctly, Your Honor, what I would look to is Minnesota Statute 257C03 Subdivision 8 that essentially requires the district court to dismiss a petition at the petition stage.
Right. No, I agree with your reading of the statute. That's okay. Not my question. It's okay. About standing.
Thank you.
Is this really a standing issue, or is it, you're absolutely right. And they don't deny it. The appellants do not meet the statutory requirements and their petition must be dismissed under the terms of the statute.
And I think when I was looking at the way that the issue was raised at the district court level, Your Honor, because this didn't move on to the second stage, I viewed Mr. DeWalt's arguments at both the district court level and now here at the appellate level as essentially saying, yep, we understand we don't have standing, which is maybe a little bit of a different type of argument since they're conceding that point and then going on to argue about the constitutionality of the point. So I don't disagree that they are two different things. And with that, but what the way I view Mr. DeWalt's argument is that they were still entitled to a hearing on the merits. There are a couple of different points being raised before Your Honors, but one of the points that I reviewed was, yep, we don't have standing, but if you would have listened to our arguments at the district court level, you would have heard about the close relationship and maybe expanded on some of the things that were in the petition. And even so, the way that the statute is written should not allow the argument to advance. I also noted that there were quite a few arguments made about kind of an alternative form of standing if it's not under the statute, that common law sort of creates an alternative path for the grandparents here generally or specifically in this case to move forward. And there's a couple of citations to cases, Olson versus Olson and RAN, that the appellant kind of wants this court to take a look and say, well, if we don't qualify under the statute, there still is this alternative path forward under common law. And frankly, Your Honors, neither of those cases lay any type of alternative framework for the appellants to seek grandparent visitation. They have no legal recourse to seek visitation with their grandchildren. Neither Olson nor RAN support a common law right to seek visitation outside the statute. And as we've talked about, the statute is very clear. If the requirements are not met under the petition at the petition stage, then simply put, the petition must be dismissed and the district court handled that correctly. We talked a lot in Mr. DeWalt's, well, I didn't talk, but I heard a lot in Mr. DeWalt's conversation about the rights of grandparents and the rights of children. And frankly, Your Honors, that's at the crux of this issue here today. The fundamental rights that we are talking about are the parents' rights to control the care, custody, and control of their children. That is the fundamental right that must be protected. Troxell comes out and says, you can't have a statute that does not allow for best interest to be the only analysis. It must be narrowly tailored to protect this fundamental right. And that's where the concept of the strict scrutiny, of course, comes in. The legislature here has determined the places where a grandparent is entitled to petition for visitation. And to say that the grandparents are placed in a separate class, grandparents in and of themselves are not a protected class. There is nothing that would say that they should be able to come forward and violate a parent's fundamental constitutional right that's been affirmed over and over again to determine who their children spend time with. I want to talk a little bit about whether the appellants should have been afforded a hearing at the second stage. The 257 statutes contemplate a two-stage process. One is the petition stage, and if the petition passes muster, then we move on to a second stage. So one of the arguments that's been advanced here is that they should have been afforded a hearing under 257C They were not entitled to a hearing, and the district court did not err in that respect either. We have to presume that this statute is constitutional. We have to presume that the legislature did not intend to violate the Constitution of the United States or of this state when they enacted 257C08. In other words, we have to presume that this statute is constitutional. The power to declare a statute unconstitutional should only be exercised with extreme caution and only when absolutely necessary. As Your Honor pointed out, the Attorney General isn't here to make any arguments, and they're not here because there was a defect in notice. But even if Your Honors were to consider overturning this statute or calling it unconstitutional, that is something that is only done in extreme cases with extreme caution. It needs to be shown beyond a reasonable doubt that the statute is unconstitutional. And Your Honor, that standard, Your Honors, that standard just has not been met here today. I look back to 2007 when there was a constitutional challenge to 257C08 in the case of Suhu versus Johnson. And that statute was deemed constitutional in that case, with the only exception being subdivision 7, which put too much of a burden on the custodial parent to show whether there would be an interference with the parent-child relationship. So when this court considered the constitutionality of this statute not too many years ago, the constitutionality was reaffirmed. The U.S. Supreme Court has stated in Troxell v. Granville that there would normally be no reason for the state to interject itself into the private realm of the family to further question the ability of that parent to make the best decisions concerning the rearing of that parent's children. That rationale and reasoning in Troxell, Your Honors, is directly relevant to what is before the court here today. The appellants are essentially asking you to remove the respondents, the parents, from this analysis and focus solely on the rights of the children and grandparents and their alleged rights. They argue that the grandparents have a right to see their grandchildren and the grandchildren have a right to see their grandparents, and that the plain language of the statute denies those rights to certain groups of grandparents. However, that doesn't work. Those relationships are not afforded fundamental rights under the Constitution. In contrast, a parent's right to make decisions for their children is granted constitutional protection under the 14th Amendment. The statute must protect those rights, not the rights of grandparents. In order to survive strict scrutiny, a law must advance a compelling state interest and must be narrowly tailored to that interest. Here we have that. The court in Troxell summarized the guiding principles for a third-party visitation statute to survive a constitutional challenge. And they are as follows. First of all, the statute must give some weight to the fit custodial parent's decision regarding visitation. Our statute does that here. There can be no presumption in favor of awarding visitation. Our statute does that here. And the court must assert more than a mere best interest analysis in support of its decision to override the fit parent's wishes. So the statute does that here. The appellants argue that it is improper for the visitation statute to treat classes of grandparents differently. However, the relevant case law analyzing grandparent visitation statutes make clear that these statutes actually must limit standing and exclude certain individuals in order to avoid interference with a parent's constitutional rights.
Ms. Lammers, yes. Pursuant to the Chief Judge's order deferring the issue, one thing we can do is just not address it at all. What would your preference be?
Your Honor, when I looked at the options, it looks like you can either not address it, limit the review to an as-applied challenge, or then apply the facial challenge as well. And just simply put here, Your Honor, I don't believe that these arguments actually even warrant addressing. There's very well-established constitutional law on these issues, and I think it would probably just be cleanest and easiest for the court to not address the challenges that are made. I don't believe that there's anything novel or new being addressed here that the court should have to analyze or look at, Your Honors. There's been a long history in the United States regarding deference to a parent's right to raise their children and have control over the care and custody of their children. A constitutional challenge of the grandparent visitation requires an application of strict scrutiny. A hearing on the merits here in this case was not required when the appellants, by their own admission, lacked standing. There's no path forward under common law. The grandparent visitation is constitutional. And Your Honors, I know I have a little bit of time left, but as I respectfully request that this court affirm the lower court's decision. And unless Your Honors have any other questions, I'd like to conclude my remarks there.
Are there any questions from the panel? Okay. Very good. Thank you, counsel. So we'll reset the clock. And there it is. You've got 5 minutes, Mr. DeWalt.
Thank you. Two things, Your Honor. One, there is a common law right to contact your grandchildren. It's set forth in case law, and it predated the enactment of 257C and its predecessor statute. And it was never extinguished. And that is actually very plain. Now that right may be quite limited, but that doesn't mean that the district court unilaterally nor respondents have the right to just simply say, well, you would lose, ergo you don't have a hearing. That was clear error in not allowing the matter to proceed, particularly given the fact of the language in Roe Miller v. Hart, wherein the Supreme Court identified that whether or not—
Well, I'd like to sort of go forward with understanding how this would work. So let's say for the sake of argument, we did rule that there is a constitutional right for your clients to see their grandchildren. And let's say then the district court sets up some schedule. And I don't know what it would be. Let's say they get to see them, you know, once a month for a weekend or something. I mean, I don't know. And let's say for the sake of argument, the parents, for their own reasons, don't allow that. Would you contemplate then the grandparents being able to move in district court for a contempt citation against the parents in order to enforce their constitutional rights to see their grandchildren?
If it was pursuant to a court order, I expect my client, they would have the same rights as every other grandparent, John. I assume.
So you would envision then their ability to seek contempt sanctions against the parents. Is that a fair statement?
It would depend on the circumstance, Your Honor, but
here's the circumstance. The court ordered the grandparents get to see the children once a weekend for an overnight, and the parents say no. Would it be your understanding then that the grandparents could then move for contempt against the parents for violating that order?
Yes, Jim. Like every other grandparent and grandchild visitation order in Minnesota, my clients would have the right to enforcement of that. The contempt, obviously, when it comes to visitation, whether it's for grandparents or parents, is a very problematic issue at the district court level. And I'm not sure that that would necessarily be the remedy I would initially seek, Your Honor. But if you're asking, do I think there would be a lesser degree of rights, I don't. And the reason, again, the statute is plain. It really is very plain in how it's written. The sole status for determining standing, not for the parents, but for grandparents, third parties, and for grandchildren, is the status of the parents. It's the only statute, I think, in Minnesota family law that determines a third party's rights to statutorily protected visitation based not on actions they do. It's not their relationship with the grandchildren. My clients took care of the children 3 days a week, two overnights a week for 18 months. That's undisputed. They literally almost raised these children to a degree. They have met every statutory criteria other than the one. The one statutory criteria they did not meet was if the parents of the children were neither divorced or unmarried in the subject of a parent's exemption. That's the only thing they didn't meet. That is literally the only criteria that's not met. So when Ms. Lammers argues that we pled out under 257C08, that is an erroneous statement. We pled it out to say this matter should have proceeded to a hearing for determination under the common law after Troxell, whether or not a derivative right to grandparent visitation was able to survive a challenge, provided they could show it would not interfere with the parent-child relationship and would be in the best interest of the children. So by clear and convincing evidence. The notable thing about this case, Your Honors, is that as opposed to Roe Miller v. Hart, where the appellant conceded they could not survive a Troxel challenge, we have specifically argued, and I think the evidence supports, they can survive a Troxel challenge. They actually can. Literally, the only determining factor preventing these children from maintaining a connection with the individuals who have been with them since birth and who raised them to a great degree. We put the percentages into the pleadings of time that they spent conservatively is the sole status of the parents. That is literally how 257C08 reads. And that is the reason that this challenge is being brought, Your Honors. I recognize that parents obviously have a fundamental right, but once the legislature chose to create access for that right, they needed to do so in a way that was equally applied to all parties. I see my time is up, Your Honors. Unless the courts have further questions, I appreciate the time and the opportunity.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both counsel in this case for the briefing as well as the oral argument. The matter is now presented to this court for a decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.